Welcome, it's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, viewing a play online and art at your local racetrack. Before we get to it, though, a reminder that we're now in the on-air portion of our spring membership campaign, now our summer membership campaign. It had been delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic. We're calling it Now More Than Ever. And with that in mind, we do need your help now more than ever. It's listener financial support which makes up the bulk of our operating budget. This is how public radio works. KVCR brings you programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Here and Now. There's so much to choose from here at KVCR, and it's listener support which makes it even possible. Make a contribution in any amount online at kvcrnews.org/support or call 877-512-8843. Again, that's kvcrnews.org/support or call 877-512-8843. Any and all contributions add up to bring you the programs that you've come to expect. And thank you so much for being next. Now on to KVC Arts. Later in the program, we'll hear about At the Pass, a play written by UC Riverside professor Stu Krieger, directed by UCR professor Bella Merlin, along with assistant director Stephanie Padilla, a UCR student. The play revolves around waitresses at a diner and a corporate challenge. KVCR's Benjamin Perper gives us more on this. First, though, some art in our area. Quite recently, NASCAR banned the display of the Confederate battle flag at events. While some are bemoaning such a loss, there's something new at the track in our region. Muralist Jonas Never recently created a piece serving as tribute to Jimmy Johnson, 7-time NASCAR Cup Series champion. Jonas has murals hanging all around California and well beyond, but this piece is the first of his in the Inland Empire. Lillian Vasquez spoke quite recently with Jonas Never.
Tell me how you as an artist got started.
I started off as a graffiti artist, and that was long before the Banksy movie and before like street art or urban art had become like an acceptable thing. And just like growing up on the west side of LA, Venice Beach, the LA River, there were so many kind of outdoor gallery type spaces. And then actually when I was playing baseball at UC Riverside, it was a quarter system. And between getting up at like 6 in the morning to go to condition and practice and school and all that, I realized there was zero time to actually study for these semesters that were getting crammed into 8 weeks. And I'd always liked art, but I never took it seriously. And a professor there kind of helped guide me into figuring out what I cared about and putting it on canvas at the time. From then on, I realized I actually liked art just as much as baseball. And then I ended up getting hurt and baseball ended. Dove back into art and started doing canvases and gallery shows, and I didn't like how people would have to go to the show, because it was before Instagram and MySpace and whatnot, so people would actually have to go to the show to see your work. And I thought, with the weather being so good and there being so many like murals from the 80s and 70s in Venice, I kind of wanted to start doing the same thing. And a barbershop chain called Floyd's 99 Barbershops started opening up in Southern California, and they liked my work and asked me to kind of do what I do on canvas on their walls. And the good thing about murals that they kind of act as billboards for both yourself and the company you're painting for. So similar companies started asking me to do that same kind of stuff, but tailor it to their kind of dynamics. And that led to doing murals full time.
When you first started, what was your subject matter, or did your subject matter become what people asked you to do?
Early on, a lot of the subject matter was pinup girls, old cars, kind of the California like beach hot rod culture. And then I realized that kind of felt limiting. And when you're doing public art, it has to tie in to the area you're painting and to a certain extent. So when I started doing more and more murals, I wanted to figure out a way to tap into the actual community that I was painting in. And so that led to me researching, you know, their history, what movies were filmed there, what teams were close by, and that made it much more fun and much more involved for both me and the community.
Tell me some of the murals you've already done, where they are and what the subject matters were.
So some of my favorite murals I've done were back in maybe 2011, 2012. I did a giant mural in Venice Beach based on the Orson Welles movie Touch of Evil, because it was actually filmed on that block. And at that time, Venice was super colorful and just really only a daytime city. And I wanted to bring sort of like the noir aspect, like nightlife to that. And still the biggest mural I've ever done. It was like 100 feet by 50 feet pretty much. And that one kind of got me realizing more and more how much fun it was to tie stuff in and where locals would get it and tourists would still appreciate it. Shortly thereafter, I think I did a Karate Kid mural out in the valley where that movie was filmed. Done a million Lakers and Kobe, LeBron, like a lot of Lakers themed stuff, you know, in downtown where the Lakers play. As I kept going, did Bob Ross in Orlando, where Bob Ross is from. Mr. Rogers went to college there, Rollins College. So I painted him right across the street from the college. Did Hank Gathers and Bo Kimble across from Loyola Marymount where they played college basketball. Did Anthony Bourdain on a New York-themed restaurant in Los Angeles.
So how did they find you? Obviously, you have good advertisement with your murals, but you do a variety of subjects. So how did they find you for so many different genres?
I've always signed my murals, never, so like people would kind of notice a common denominator of that. And then oftentimes, even if they didn't notice, they'd call the barbershop or the bowling alley I painted and ask who did the artwork. And then it was easier than just putting my info on the wall and end up getting some weird phone calls. But yeah, kind of work begets work. And at that point, there weren't many people doing realistic, you know, murals. And I think some of the people really got the theme I was going for, and they could visualize the same sort of stuff going on their wall, but with their own concept. Like, I know Josh Avila from Auto Club Speedway saw a segment on SportsCenter about me where I'd done a lot of LA-themed sports murals and just talked NASCAR on the show. I think he realized that that was applicable here, and that led to, you know, how me being out here right now.
All right, so tell me about what you're going to be doing for Jimmy Johnson.
So Jimmy Johnson is pretty much the most amazing Southern California driver ever, and he's always, you know, made it very clear that Auto Club Speedway was one of his favorite tracks. And when he announced his upcoming retirement back in November, he noted a couple times how much he was looking forward to this race. So that kind of led to Josh and the guys at Auto Club Speedway discussing the possibility of doing something to honor Jimmy for his final race in SoCal. And street art is a very Los Angeles thing. I mean, it's obviously big throughout the world now, but LA's always been known for it, and the whole Southern California. And I'd never really done a big mural in the Inland Empire before, and this seemed like a perfect opportunity to kind of bring everything together.
Obviously, your subject matter has already been selected for you, but when you think of Jimmy Johnson, is there a picture that you want to emulate? Where are you getting your idea for what Jimmy Johnson will look like on this mural?
Well, the good thing about Jimmy Johnson, he's had so many great moments here and throughout his career. It gave us a lot of pictures to choose from. So I wanted the main image to be one where it's very clearly him, where he's recognizable from afar. So as you're, you know, pulling up to the speedway, you can see his face. And then around, we're going to do his 48 and then a few moments of him winning at Auto Club Speedway. I think we've got his first win here. We've got a few other ones when he had the Superman car, and kind of tie in both the history and the now. So he can stand next to it, and it won't just be like a young version of him. It'll be all different versions of him.
As a muralist, how do you get started? Can you tell me the process?
Absolutely. So once I get the wall, I pretty much take a photo of the wall so I can start mocking up how things should lay out. And I can see if there's a drain pipe, if there's a way it should be facing, or, you know, how to kind of make sure everything fits. I don't want his head cropped off funny or, you know, missing something very important. And from there, I'll throw everything into Photoshop and make sure the dimensions are correct once I have the measurements for the wall. And that way I know when I get here, I can kind of hit the ground running. And by doing all the renderings in Photoshop, if there's something that people want changed or want to see look different, I can give them a few options. Whereas if I'm hand drawing all my renderings, then it's a slower process in this way.
And what are you doing here? It looks like you are hand drawing.
So I sketched him out just to make sure all the important stuff's there. You know, one funny thing about NASCAR is there's a million sponsors on all their stuff. So I had to make sure if the logos are wrong, it looks wrong. And so I sketched out his face and then Ally and the Cup Series logos, all the stuff that really there's no room for error on. Like if I was doing LeBron, I'd do the same thing with his face and the Lakers logo. But here, I figure get started, do the face, 'cause that's the first thing, you know, you want people to know who you're painting. And then from there, I'm going to work my way down top to bottom. So if anything drips, it's on something I haven't painted yet.
And how long will it take you, hour-wise?
It's going to take some time. He's got a lot of accomplishments, so it's going to be a lot to paint.
So what are you thinking? 12 hours, 50 hours, 70 hours? What are you thinking?
Well, let's see. Today, putting maybe a week and a half on this, working long days. And that's if all goes well. If not, we'll be going right up till qualifying at the race.
You mentioned that you were a baseball player and you played at UC Riverside?
Yes.
So a lot of what you're talking about, obviously you're an athlete, so sports must have been important to you, are still important to you. Do you find that's the majority of your subject matter? Other than you mentioned the movies, but is that where you lean towards?
I think I always gravitate to sports, partially because they tie so well to the communities, or whether it be where the player or driver's from or where the team's based. So there's a lot you can tie into areas. And because I've always loved sports, it's nice to do something you love. And I follow sports anyways, might as well stay involved with it best I can. And painting them is a great opportunity to do such.
Any regrets not playing baseball, or have you really enjoyed your mural career?
It's weird for me now, where most of my friends I played with and against are now retiring. So even though I'm still young for art, I'm old for playing baseball. So I don't want to be like the rookie who came back to pitch for the Rays when he was like 40. So I'm fine with where I'm at, and everything happens for a reason. As long as my arm doesn't get too sore painting, I'm all right.
So that was going to be my next question. I mean, you threw with your right-handed,
yes.
Threw with your, and you're drawing right-handed. Does your arm get tired?
My arm still gets a little tired, but it's a good problem to have. It means I'm painting a lot and getting a lot of work. So just like after a day of pitching, I have to ice it every now and again, but I'm happy doing what I love.
What would you tell a young muralist who maybe started off as graffiti? When you talk about being a graffiti artist, does that mean you were marking up buildings that shouldn't have been marked up?
I was not necessarily doing what I should do, but I wasn't as daredevil-y as some, and I never did anything too bad. It was a lot of like underneath freeway bridges and a lot of like the abandoned pavilion in Venice Beach. So I felt like I kind of out of sight, out of mind. There was plenty of stuff I shouldn't have done, but I think once I started transitioning into murals, that part was like very much behind me, but applied all the skills I learned doing that, both the lack of a fear of heights and how to go big and relatively fast. And I think what worked best for me was that I really found subject matter I cared about. And when I started, most kind of murally type things were had the same themes. It was like underwater, it was frozen, it was not the movie, but like actually snowy. And I didn't really get how people could be entertained doing the same thing over and over. So I found, you know, sports, movies, pop culture, stuff that I really enjoyed, musicians. Like I did a Social Distortion mural in Orange County a few years ago, just because they were such a big band down there. And by putting the stuff I cared about on the wall, I was much more passionate about it. And I think I was that much more invested in the finished product. And, you know, knowing that Jimmy Johnson's going to be there this weekend, that really drives me to make this wall look good. So it actually looks like him and he can be happy with it. So if you're a young muralist getting out there, I'd say, you know, push yourself, find what you care about and just keep working on it. Like you can always get better.
Talking to a young artist that maybe hasn't found his or her way, but they have a God-given talent, as yours is obviously a given talent, to be able to draw and paint and bring your images to life. What do you say to that person?
I'd say stay open-minded. When I got the opportunity to paint that big wall in Venice, got almost a decade ago, I really didn't know what I was going to do on that wall. And I knew I wanted something historic and something that wouldn't feel dated in a few years. So I just kept researching and looking up stuff, like looking at other artists' work, looking at the history of Venice. And at that point, one day randomly, I stumbled across the movie Get Shorty, and they were talking about Touch of Evil. I was like, oh, I totally missed that. So if you keep getting out there and keep working as an artist and working and kind of figuring out what you care about and what makes sense, like I'm still learning, you have to find good reference photos. The reference photo is a huge part of this. So make sure your photos are clear, make sure you care about your subject matter, and you can always improve. I mean, Jimmy's still pushing himself and he's been racing forever. Can I approach artwork the same way? Just keep striving to be the best you can.
What's your next canvas going to be?
I'm going to finish up a Kobe Bryant mural at Grand Central Market in downtown LA. Then after that, it's going to be a pretty whirlwind. Going to do a wall for LAFC, the soccer team in LA. Then going to go to Atlanta to do a couple walls down there. Going to do one in Oxnard for Bolera Bowling Alleys and pretty much stay busy for the rest of the year and hopefully forever.
Has your name helped you at all? The last name of Never? Have you played on that or done anything with the name?
I was going to play on it, and then that was right around when the Finding Neverland movie came out, so I vetoed that idea pretty quickly. I didn't want to be tied into all that stuff, but at some point I think I want to do one with Peter Pan, play some sort of play on that, but we'll see. I have a million ideas for things I want to do, but then opportunities like this pop up and everything else gets shuffled back, and I'm totally all right with that.
How would others find you? Where would they go to find your artwork?
If you want to find my artwork, it's just on Instagram right now. It's never1959, and 59 was a number I wore in baseball, and I didn't want it to be like any confusion with the numbers. I figured 1959 was easier to remember than just 59, so never 1959.
So I thought 59 would have been the year you were born, but clearly not.
It was one of those weird things. My favorite band, the Gaslight Anthem, their big album is called The 59 Sound. I love jersey number 59, and the first car I bought with my own money was a 59 Edsel, so I tied it all together, but 59 on its own is a little too close to a number that people write jokingly on walls too much, so I want to stay away from that entirely.
Thanks, Jonas.
No problem. Thank you.
That was KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with muralist Jonas Never. His stunning work, paying tribute to 7-time NASCAR Cup Series champion Jimmy Johnson, can be seen at the Auto Club Speedway in Fontana. Let's go now to KVCR's Benjamin Perper with more on At the Pass, a play out of UC Riverside, which was done through Zoom, is available on YouTube, and will soon be available as a podcast. And thanks for hearing from you next.
We're here with Professor Stu Krieger, who wrote At the Pass, Professor Bella Merlin, who directed At the Pass, and UCR student Stephanie Padilla, the show's student assistant director. I'll start with Stu. How did the idea for this play come about?
The whole reason At the Pass came into existence is in 2000, probably it was late 2017, we were at a faculty meeting, and we always have to talk about our season. We do 3 main stage productions a year in addition to student written film festival, play festival, and a graduate play festival. So, you know, we're constantly in some form of production all year long. So we plan our season more than a year out, because especially with some of the, you know, established plays, we have to worry about acquiring rights and making schedules and doing all of that. So this was probably, like I said, in late 2017 at a faculty meeting, we were talking about the subsequent upcoming seasons. And I made a comment, which is always be careful what you wish for, where I said, you know, in the time I've been here since 2006, we've never done a contemporary comedy, and we're training actors that eventually are going to graduate our program and go out and audition in L.A., and they've never had practice doing contemporary comedy. I think it would be interesting to introduce that. And, you know, we've done Shakespeare comedies, we've done some classic comedies, but just our contemporary plays tend to be heavy dramas. So I made that comment. Everybody turned and looked at me and said, okay, well, write something, because, you know, we've also been trying to feature more faculty work so that the students have the experience of being able to work with the playwright as well as the director while we're in production. So I took up the challenge. I was on sabbatical in the fall of 2018. I wrote the play, sent it to the faculty. They decided they wanted to do it. And it was a two-act comedy set in a diner. And the whole genesis of the idea was I had several students over several months coming to me in office hours, and they were constantly talking about the disconnect between intellectually understanding that everything that everybody posts on social media is about their best days, and they're not posting, you know, their crappy days and their bad vacations and everything else, but they still intellectually buy into the thought of why is everybody having more fun than I am. And it was this really interesting disconnect that kept coming up over and over again. And so I kind of went, oh, I want to write something about that. And especially if it's, you know, a play that we know we're going to produce with our students, I want to write all age-appropriate characters so it's something that we can cast easily, something that they can relate to, and make it about something that they care about and are invested in. So I was trying to figure out, that's the genesis. What's the form? What's the format? Where? What happens? And my wife and I were sitting in a diner on New Year's Eve that year, and I was watching the waitresses come up to the pass, and they would drop off a ticket and talk to each other and talk about somebody else that was in the restaurant, and then one would leave and another would come and they'd talk about her. And it was one of those epiphany moments of, okay, there's my play. I want to write about these waitresses in a diner who, when we first meet them, only know each other through their social media personas and all the things they're posting. And then when this crisis of the corporate intervention comes in, little by little, they have to know who they really are and what they really care about to be able to, you know, fight the force. So that's where it came from. The intention was it was going to be our main stage spring play. And then the pandemic hit and campus shut down. And Bella said, you know, the show must go on. Let's figure out a way we can do this. And that's how we got to starting to create what the virtual version was going to be.
Can you kind of speak to how that happened, how that transition to virtual happened?
Sure. This is Bella Merlin. I directed it, the hybrid version. My main imperative, to be honest, was to keep as close to a normal experience for the students as possible. It felt like the world was in such disarray. How can we hold on to some sense of what we would normally be doing if suddenly this chaos wasn't swirling around us? So I looked at all the conditions of a stage play. What's the rehearsal schedule? Who are the team? What are the steps you go through? Technical rehearsals, dress rehearsals, opening night, etc., post-show party. And I thought, let's try and keep that same schedule. At the same time, I had design students for whom there was no longer anything really to design, and stage managers for whom there was no longer anything concrete in the physical realm to stage manage. So that's when the idea of bringing in Foley sound effects, live created, came in, because we also have the most wonderful staff member, Kerry Jones, who's normally our wonderful scenic painter, but she also has worked a lot with live radio stage plays. So I knew she had a vivid imagination about how to create a landscape in our imagination through sound effects. And that then birthed, if you like, the hybrid performance idea of having a combination between a rehearsed reading, a radio play that has the live Foley, the filmic close-up, which is really what the Zoom screens are doing. And we're a theater, film, and digital production department, so it made sense to be linking a theatrical experience with a filmic experience. along with the live theater performance, because I totally value the exchange between the actor and the audience during that moment of a live theater event. So how might we create that? Well, let's bring together all our technology to try and allow on May the 14th, when we went live at 8 p.m., a genuine kind of live audience experience. And I can't deny it was hair-raising, because the one unknown quotient here is the technology. You never quite know whose computer it might go down, or which household might be spreading the bandwidth so much as they're tuning in to watch the performance that actually suddenly the individual actors and the Foley artists don't necessarily have all the technology they need. So to cover that, two of the team members were my student assistant directors. Stephanie Padilla, who is with us at the moment, was one of those, and Winter Lawson was our other assistant director and also dramaturg. So they not only attended all the rehearsals, as Stephanie will tell you in a minute, but they also leapt in should the technology fail. So really trying to keep a normal experience for the students in the chaos, and also trying to give the audience some taste of what live theater is all about.
Yeah, I wanted to ask what kind of snafus happened during the premiere. Maybe that's a question for Stephanie.
I think that's a great question for Stephanie.
Yeah. So a lot of technology did fail on us during our performance, during our live performance. And one of them, one of our cast members, Joe, he was actually down for the majority of the play. And it was really unexpected because he never had any internet connections prior. So I was like constantly had to like keep up with the script and just keep in contact with everyone else that I could reach out to. So I was in contact with Ben Tusher, with Bella, and with Joe also, as well as the other assistant director, Winter, and just really tried to keep the production as smooth as we could during the live performance. And on top of that, we did have people go down during rehearsals as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And you would leap in and cover for them, wouldn't you, Stephanie?
Yeah.
So you would do their parts for them?
And just like, I would go ahead and read their parts for them every time the technology would go ahead and break down.
Okay. So that happened pretty often then? I mean, were people dropping out and you said one didn't have internet access at all?
Well, initially that would happen a lot more, but during our live stream performance, if I recall correctly, it only happened once. Actually, no, twice. His internet decided to break down for the first time in the entire quarter that night. And then we did have someone come in late on their queue, but I did cover for them. It was only briefly.
What was it like working as an assistant director for this play? What did you learn from the experience?
Well, with me, since I want to be an actor, I primarily learned how to work better with directors in general and how to be more of a workable actor and sense of technicality. So I kind of took away what other actors in return like did, not necessarily for me, but like in their response and how they took direction and how quick they took to respond to emails and all that. I guess in like a technicality sense, I did learn how to become a better actor. I also did learn like sort of the behind the scenes and how directing works as well, since the relationship between actors and directors are very critical on set.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you have any words of praise for the faculty at UCR and how they kind of managed to put all these plays on despite having a relatively smaller faculty?
I have nothing but respect for the faculty at UCR. They're very caring, very humble, and they generally want the best for you. And it kind of makes me grateful that we do have like the sort of like smaller onset of faculty, just because they all like know who you are. They all know what you want to do, what you aspire to do. With that being said, I do feel like we do need like sort of a bigger set of faculty. It's sort of getting harder to keep up with everything. I know for like other classes such as CFD20, they used to be able to do on-hand set experience. And if you don't know, CFDB20 is a technical design class. So, but now, since there are so many students, we basically have to learn through slideshow, which isn't as engaging as it used to be.
Okay.
And if I can jump in on that, Ben, one of the issues has been the department itself is growing tremendously while the faculty is not.
Yeah.
So I was department chair from 2012 to 2016. And when I took over as chair in 2012, we had 78 majors, and this year we have 480, and we only have one more faculty person than we had when we had 78.
Wow.
So the issue that Stephanie's referring to, which has become an ongoing critical, you know, it's part budget, it's part departmental, it's part college-wise, trying to get new faculty lines approved, is we're trying to now, with the same amount of faculty, service 480 students in a way we were able to service 78 previously. And so that's the constant tug of war, as the administration is encouraging us to grow, but then not supporting us with the faculty to give the students the experience they deserve.
One of the things that always inspires me about the students is how incredibly inventive and committed they are. And with our really rather wonderful production team that's led by our production manager, Ben Tusher, who Stephanie mentioned earlier, and some of our recent graduated students, Johnny Macias was our technological stage manager, if you like, helping us with all the behind the scenes, for want of a better word, interactions through the online chat facility, through the text messaging, you know, all the things that would normally be backstage calls, we were doing those, navigating all those behind the scenes. And when we had the post-show party, which was a Zoom event, bring your own drinks, bring your own snacks, obviously, because we were on Zoom, it was very inspiring to hear the students all reflect on how inventive the situation had encouraged them to be, and how resourceful and how resilient. And despite the fact that we, as Stu says, we have almost four times the number of students we had with a similar number of faculty, it encourages them to be self-sufficient and create projects, especially at this time of social distancing, where inventing their own stories created through the film classes, through the playwriting festivals. It's truly inspiring, and much as, yes, the increased number of faculty would be wonderful, I'm always inspired by the ingenuity and the resourcefulness of the students.
Yeah, no, it sounds like
because she won't tell you herself, Ben, I will tell you that the amount of time and energy and thought and heart that Bella put into making this all come to life was incredible. It was just amazing how tireless and fearless she was in plowing through and making sure it happened and making sure everybody was involved and engaged and had a role to play, as she said, transitioning it, you know, from what would have been the live stage version to the virtual world. She was just unbelievably meticulous about making sure everybody had something important to do and contribute.
And while other online performances have been happening all around a similar time, because I guess many of us as institutions were hitting the similar time of the quarter, so that's just when productions would be coming out, I don't think anybody has done what we've done in terms of live Foley effect, the filmic close-up, and the live experience.
Can we talk a little bit about the Foley effects? What are those, just for our listeners who don't know what that is?
These are sound effects named after Mr. Foley you'd know this more than me, Stu, actually. Was this in the movies rather than radio drama,
yeah,
or both?
I believe it started in film, the actual Foley effects. But having sound effects in radio dramas absolutely preceded film. But I think the Foley thing is a filmic term, I believe.
And the idea is that you're creating live effects that create a sound that might not be the actual object. Often they are for our play, because the past is set in a diner. We had lots of sound of silverware and plates and pots and pans and doors opening and closing as customers came in and out of the diner. But also sometimes they might be objects that you wouldn't immediately think would be the sound effect. And this is where Kerry Jones, our Foley designer, had all sorts of inspirations up her sleeve. And we spent a long time trying to find, for example, what, you know, there was lots of cashing up at the cash till. So how do we create the tinging of the cash register, or the sound effect of the receipt that actually makes enough noise? So she was constantly being inventive. And one of the characters that Stu had written was a mime, which on the theater stage would be perfectly straightforward. How are we going to do that in a version where we're relying on different theatrical devices. So we had all sorts of circus effect. Actually, the sounds were created by the student, Brenda, who had a young sibling. And so she just got all the soft toys and the baby toys and rattles and things so that we were able to punctuate the mimes part of the story with children's toys. Obviously, it's out of shot, so you don't quite see what's being done, but you hear the sound of them. You hear an oral accompaniment to the silent dialogue that the mime is conjuring up.
And so I assume all that's going to go into the podcast version, right, too?
Yes, those oral effects will be a layering of the storytelling.
So how does that work? How do you do a podcast when everyone is at their own homes, maybe?
So what I'm in the process of doing with the team at UC Riverside called Excite, and this is the IT team, of whom they have several student participants. So the ongoing project is working with one of the student editors there, Harley Grow, and basically he's assembling all the audio tracks from all the various rehearsals we did. And it'll be a meticulous ongoing edit. So he'll be trying to capture for a radio drama from the Zoom edits that we've got, editing out all the delays that the technology put in and finding the best take. So it's going to be a meticulous ongoing project. We're working on the schedule because the process is more intricate than you might think. So we're currently in dialogue this very moment almost about when can we, because we want to make sure if the audience is listening on headphones, many of the sound glitches, if you like, that happen through the Zoom that are inevitable part of the technology, they're heightened when you're just listening through the earphones. So we want to make sure we take the time it requires to get the smoothness of effect and the highest quality that we can get that pays homage to the script, the actors, the technology, the editing.
And where will that be available to listen to? On podcast apps or on the website, or where can we listen to that?
So we were navigating that with Ben Tusher, our production manager. I'm imagining that it will be, through the university website, the departmental website, and then we'll figure out what also then is the best app. You catch us in the moment of part of the experiment. All along this has been what we'd call practice as research. UC Riverside is a Research One institution, so every class, if you like, is part of the process of researching. So you catch us in the middle of how we navigate this particular manifestation of the experiment.
Great. Well, that was all my questions. I want to give you guys a chance to talk about whatever you want to talk about in regards to the play. Stu, I'll start with you. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
Yeah, for me as the writer, there's the journey that we've all been on, which is the excitement that the play was getting produced, and then we had wonderful casting sessions, and we're really thrilled about the cast we assembled, and then the notification that the campus was being shut down, and that disappointment and dip, and something the students talk quite a bit about, of the high and then the low, and then Bella kind of just, like I said, I've got a barn, we're going to put on a show, and figuring out how we could make that happen and what it was going to be. And for me as the writer, part of the trepidation is, okay, we're moving to this new platform. It's a comedy. Comedy is so dependent on timing. And how do you get comic timing established when everybody's in their own separate home, in their own separate box on the screen, trying to relate to one another? And watching what Bella did through the rehearsal process and watching the actors kind of start to take ownership of their characters and understand who they were and what the relationships were was really exciting. And I remember late in the process, there was a night when I sat in on rehearsal and suddenly everything was really clicking and it was firing, and the kids really, like I said, had done their homework and dug deep into who the characters were, and the timing was working and the comedy was working. And Bella's husband, Miles, was sitting in on one of the rehearsals and I could hear him laughing, and it was like, wow, this is going to work. We're going to be able to pull this off. And it's a different form. It's a different version of what we intended to do. We hope one day, if the campus ever does reopen, we will be able to do the live stage production. But watching it become its own thing and succeed as its own thing was very exciting and very fulfilling, and just such a tribute to Bella and the students and the whole entire team.
Bella, do you have anything else to say?
The building of community was probably one of the most exciting things, and Stephanie was instrumental in that. She ran warm-ups along with her fellow assistant director, Winter. She held independent rehearsals with the actors, which she initiated herself, and that sense of community was really deeply inspiring. And we're going to be keeping the recording of the live version up on YouTube so that people can still access it. It's had over 1,400 views to date. And while we wait for podcast version, we're going to keep the YouTube recording up so people can still see that. So I'll make sure that you have the link to that so that it's still out there as an artifact, an archival representation of what we were trying to achieve. So I'm really so proud of the students, and I'm so excited that Stu ran with it and helped us transition the script from a theater piece into this hybrid version, part radio, part film, part live. So yeah, it was a really exciting experience.
Oh, and that was one other thing I wanted to add, Ben, also that Bella just touched on, which was, you know, when we had to convert from the stage version to the radio play version, one of the considerations was the very first thing we did with the cast is we did a table read. And if you're familiar with the traditional table read, somebody just reads the narration and reads the stage direction. And, you know, cast enters, moves to the pass, puts a ticket on the window. And in doing that, we quickly realized that as a radio play version, it would be incredibly deadly in terms of, again, what I was saying about trying to establish pace and establish rhythm in comedy to have to read the stage direction. So Bella and Ben and I had this confab about, all right, how are we going to work around that? And came up with the idea of, we've got these students who are basically going to be extras in the play, playing the customers in the restaurant. What if we made the customers actual narrators and characters in the play so that we didn't have to do just dry stage direction? And that was another, you know, inventing as we go, figuring it out, converting to the new media, and then being able to sit with Bella and talk about what we needed to hear and what we could actually have the actors act and show us because they were going to be on camera. And so the invention of those four narrators that narrated each of the day was just another, you know, necessity is the mother of invention moment of, okay, they're suddenly characters, they're narrators, they're customers. And that's where that came from.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Any last words, Stephanie?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to the sense of solidarity that we created. Initially, I was very much surprised we were able to like create such a strong connection through something that wasn't physical. And part of it was, I noticed that through warm-ups, we had everyone turn out their mics, we had everyone turn on their cameras if we can all see each other. Like you said, the chats did create a sense of solidarity because we weren't afraid to like post like an occasional joke or two in the chat, and that overall made the team stronger and it gave a stronger performance. And then when I individually met with the actors, they were all very much respectful, very diligent, and they worked very hard. They took everything what I had to say very seriously because everyone just wanted to generally what was best for the play, given that everything was online. And from what I did here, even though the majority of the cast is going to be graduating, leaving UCR, they're all really eager to potentially return one day and do the whole play again.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you all for doing this. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait for the podcast. It's going to be fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
That was KVCR's Benjamin Perper. We've been hearing about At the Pass, a play written by UC Riverside professor Stu Krieger, directed by UCR professor Bella Merlin, along with assistant director Stephanie Padilla, a UCR student. It was captured on Zoom, is available on YouTube, and will soon be available as a podcast. I'm David Fleming. You're listening to KVC Arts. And before we close out the program, a reminder once again that we're in our Now More Than Ever membership campaign, originally set to begin in April, but had to be delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic. We are happy to be with you now, though, and we look forward to hearing from you with a financial contribution in any amount. This is what pays for the programs here on KVCR. Listener support truly makes up most of our operating budget. So many different amounts from so many different listeners coming together to make this type of programming possible in our region. Give at kvcrnews.org or by phone if you wish, if it's more convenient, call 877-512-8843. 877-512-8843 or kvcrnews.org/support. Either way you give, thank you so much. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Stu Krieger, Bella Merlin, and Stephanie Padilla, all at UC Riverside. Thanks also to muralist Jonas Never. You can see his work on Instagram and more. Just do an image search for Jonas Never. Get ready to be blown away. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Benjamin Perper, and Shireen Awad. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, and Google Play, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Also, you can now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year, though we're looking for that call or pledge online right now during our summer membership campaign. Just go to kvcrnews.org/support or call 877-512-8843. And thanks again.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And an email came into our office this week from a listener urging me to make a phone call.
Hello?
Hey, is this David?
Yes, this is David. May I ask who's calling?
Doesn't he sound suspicious? He was totally right to be. I explained who I was and what this was all about. So I got this email from your friend Nicole, who says that you listen to a lot of public radio. And she said she had a conversation with you. I can't tell if this is text messages or Twitter or what.
It was a Facebook conversation, I think.
It's a Facebook conversation where you guys were talking about public radio. She says, are you a member or are you freeloading off the generosity of other listeners? You write back, still freeloading, !!
Yep.
And she says, don't make me send Ira Glass after you.
Yeah.
And then you write back, I ain't afraid of Ira. Bring it on.
Yeah. That's it.
So here I am.
Yeah. Yeah, she's been after me for a while. Her husband actually works for public radio in Dallas.
So you basically, you listen a lot,
mm-hmm.
and you have a friend in the business.
I know, I'm a scoundrel.
And her husband, his paycheck is dependent on people like you donating money to his radio station in Dallas. For her family to eat, she needs people like you to donate if she's going to feed her family.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, I'm busted. What can I say?
This is the thing. He didn't even have an argument. On Facebook, he was all, bring it on. I had been looking forward to arguing with him about why he should give. I never even got the chance. He instantly said he would call in, he would donate.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
So, why hadn't he donated to his public radio station?
It's that inertia, you know? Nothing I can justify, just laziness, that's all. It's like I've got 1,000 other things to do today, and it's not... That one's just not at the top of my priority list. And by the time I do sit down and think about it at the end of the day, I'm wiped out and tired.
You know, I'm willing to bet that if you are hearing the sound of my voice right now, chances are you haven't donated, and chances are you are exactly like this guy. We're trying to get you to donate here during the pledge drive, and it's not even like you have a reason not to donate. You probably actually think it's right to donate the way this guy does, but you never pledge. Not because you've made a decision not to pledge, it's just inertia. Every pledge drive, it's a battle between this radio station, between us, and the eternal, unending power of sloth. And so I ask you, choose us. Choose this radio station that apparently you like enough that you don't change the channel during the pledge drive. Don't choose inertia. Don't choose the wrong side in this war. Our jobs, this radio station's existence, depends on your choice. Here's how to pledge.
Make a contribution in any amount online at kvcrnews.org/support or call 877-512-8843, 877-512-8843. Any and all contributions add up to bring you the programs that you've come to expect. And thank you so much for being next.